Case for argument this morning is Fifth Third Bank against Garzolini Tire and Fuel. Mr. Roots.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kelvin Roots. I'm the attorney for Garzolini Tire and Fuel, the newly reorganized Chapter 11 debtor. This case, the cases cited in the briefs,
Merits, I'm worried about appellate jurisdiction. The bankruptcy judge issued a series of orders that he described as granting summary judgment on counts of an adversary complaint, which had been initiated by Fifth Third Bank. And I can't tell from these papers whether the bankruptcy judge is completely 100% done with the adversary proceeding.
The adversary complaint started out filed by Fifth Third Bank, multiple counts against multiple parties. Some of those counts dealt with security interests in personal property. One of the counts dealt with a security interest in a set of truck scales at a truck stop. And one of the counts dealt with the mortgages encumbering the property in Clinton, Indiana that was sold, which is what's before the court today. All of the counts, with the exception of the one dealing with this real estate, were settled, disposed of, and we were left with just the one count.
Right. So you say by the time this appeal was filed, the adversary proceeding, everything in the adversary proceeding was over and done with?
Judge Easterbrook, I'm drawing a blank on the exact chronology.
Well, we might need you to file another set of supplemental papers. As you know, we already issued one order in this case to try to collect this information, which wasn't in your initial filings. We issued an order saying we need everything from the bankruptcy court, and it seemed to me we didn't get it. And now we're going to have to try again. But until we know that the adversary proceeding was over and done with at the time of this appeal to the district court, it doesn't seem to me we have appellate jurisdiction.
I think the court does for this reason.
And look, you have to understand, an adversary proceeding is treated as equivalent to a separate piece of civil litigation. And it's one of the most well-established principles that if there are two claims made in a piece of civil litigation and the district judge resolves one, you can't appeal till it's resolved the second, till it's resolved every single thing in the case.
Given that, Your Honor, then I would request opportunity to follow up with a supplemental response to the court.
Yes, we're very disappointed that after we'd already issued one order requiring you to provide more information, we're having to do this again.
Well, I think maybe we misinterpreted the issue that the court was looking for.
We'll give the parties 10 days to file supplemental memoranda addressing the question whether everything in the bank in this adversary proceeding, whether all claims in this adversary proceeding were resolved before the appeal was taken. And along the way, it would probably help us to know what has become of Fifth Third Bank, since this was, after all, a proceeding which looked to me in the adversary proceeding as a dispute between Fifth Third Bank and another bank, that is Edgar County Bank, about who got the security interest. And that doesn't appear to be the argument that we're having now. Fifth Third Bank appears to have vanished.
Garzolini Tire and Fuel in the action filed a cross-claim, which was its claim to file. Fifth Third then, realizing that the claim under bankruptcy law was really the claim of the debtor in possession, dismissed its claim against Edgar County Bank. That's why we have Garzolini then going up on appeal.
We need to know all of these details so we can put it together and figure out what's...
I understand, and we'll provide the court with that response within 10 days.
Thank you very much. The parties have 10 days to do this.
Thank you. As to the remaining issue between Garzolini, as I had stated, there are a number of little nuances between the various cases cited in the briefs and the cases cited in those cases, but I think that Judge Lindquist put it best in Baldwin when he boiled it down to a three-step analysis. He suggested that you need to analyze who is the mortgagor named in the instrument, who signed the instrument and in what capacity, And third, does the mortgagor acknowledge his or her signature in the notary's certificate? Going through that analysis, it's our belief that the Haverhill case decided by the Indiana Court of Appeals in 1944 is the one that most mirrors the facts in this case. In that case, it was a chattel mortgage, but all the courts have treated it the same now as mortgages in terms of acknowledgments. But it pointed out that there were multiple parties named in the mortgage: Adolph Hauerlander, Haverhill Manufacturing Corporation, Gravo Company. And then the signatures were signed by those entities: Adolph Hauerlander, Haverhill Manufacturing Corp., Gravo Company, and Adolph Hauerlander, president, but it didn't explain president of what entity. But then the confusion arose in the notary's certificate. It was indeed acknowledged. Adolph Hauerlander acknowledged execution of the instrument. There was another certificate below that that had some blanks, was not filled in, was not completed, and it's not clear from a reading of that certificate what it was intending. These are the facts that we think are most like Garzolini. Had multiple parties: Garzolini Tire and Fuel, Bruno Garzolini Jr., Robert D. Garzolini were named in the instrument. All three of them signed the instrument, but the acknowledgement only said Bruno Garzolini Jr. and Robert D. Garzolini acknowledged their signatures. Our position is, of course, that because the acknowledgement was defective, the instrument was not entitled to be recorded under Indiana law and under bankruptcy law and Indiana law both. If it was not entitled to be recorded, then it does not serve as notice to third parties. Edgar County Bank relies heavily on the Schaefer Farms case, applying Judge Lindquist's same analysis to that. The instrument was supposed to be given by Arnold and Mildred Schaefer Farms, Inc. Now, the first time we have a clue that there's something wrong is the fact that the instrument actually said Arnold and Mildred Schaefer Livestock Farms, Inc. The court seemed to say, well, that's good enough, that's close enough. I would suggest that today a real estate practitioner or a title examiner would go nuts with that type of a problem. All the time we see different entities that have just slight variations on the name. ABC LLC, ABC 1 LLC, ABC 2 LLC. And it's very important that the instruments accurately describe the grantor or the mortgagor. In Schaefer, next question, who signed? Well, in that case, Arnold and Mildred Schaefer Farms, Inc. did not sign. Rather, the signature lines were executed by Arnold Schaefer. He did put a comma and Prez, P-R-E-S, period, after his name. And Mildred Schaefer, comma, T-R-E-A-S, after her name. The notary's certificate recites that the Schaefers did indeed acknowledge execution as husband and wife. Now, Judge Sharp in the Schaefer Farms case seemed to think, well, that's good enough. It's close enough because we know the body of the complaint said it was a corporation. They signed with the words president and treasurer afterwards, so we'll let it slide and say that the instrument was entitled to be recorded. The key in that case, though, is that it was a single entity. There wasn't any confusion in the body of the instrument itself as to who was giving the mortgage. Edgar Bank also relies heavily on Mishawaka Federal versus Bradamus. In that case, once again applying the three-step analysis, who gave the instrument? In the instrument, it says that it was given by 100 Center Company on its own behalf and as general partner of Sedgwick House. That case is very clear. It's very clearly stated who the parties are, that the one party, Center Company, is indeed the general partner of Sedgwick House. So when the general partners of 100 Center Company sign, it's clear under partnership law that they have authority also to bind Sedgwick House. I want to reserve just a little bit of time for rebuttal, but clearly our position is that we see this as a Rubik's Cube. You've all played with that before. What you're trying to do is line up colors all on one side. What we are saying is that the who that's identified in the mortgage, in this case three parties, have to line up with the who signed, in this case three entities, and that must line up and match up with acknowledgments by three individuals.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Roots. Since we devoted considerable time to jurisdiction, I will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Gallagher.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Roots. My name is Mark Gallagher. I'm here as counsel for Edgar County Bank. Let me take one moment to talk about jurisdiction as well. Perhaps it will help. As to the finality of the judgment before the court today. Again, there were four counts pled in Fifth Third's initial complaint that began this action. One of the pleadings that was filed was Mr. Root's counterclaim and cross-claim asserting bankruptcy law avoidance actions. I think if you look at the judgments in the two appendices we have now filed, including our supplemental appendix, you will find the court's judgments completely addressing the claims in all of those pleadings. In the initial appendix, we supplied you with the findings of fact and conclusions of law and entry of judgment under appeal here today. In that entry, I'm looking at appendix page 15. The court entered judgment in favor of Edgar County and against not only the debtor, the appellant here today, but also against Fifth Third Bank as to the validity of my client's mortgage. It being valid, that did away, that was a final adverse ruling, not only as to the debtor's claim, but also the bank's claims.
And look, one reason why I'm confused is that even after we told you to file a new brief with a separate jurisdictional statement, your jurisdictional statement says, this is final because it finally disposed of count four of the adversary proceeding. And of course, that's not a good definition of finality.
Certainly.
To dispose of the entire adversary proceeding.
What I suppose creates a bit of confusion is that there was no unitary entry of judgment. And even 10 days from now, we can't bring the jurisdictional rule
is perfectly straightforward. Until the district court, or in this case the bankruptcy court, finally resolves the very last issue in the case, nothing is appealable. And then when that judgment is entered, everything is appealable.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
One can't appeal piecemeal from dispositions of counts.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'm trying quickly to put my finger on what we've already given you that I think ties up the different
loose ends. I hope in this filing in 10 days this can all be pinned down. We'll know got to be final, when the appeal was taken, and so on.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the merits, Your Honor, the question here is a narrow statutory question. Was my client's mortgage in conformity with Indiana's recording statute? That statute doesn't require much. It requires only that a mortgage to be entitled to recordation, have a certificate attached from a notary, certificate and the mortgage itself must show that the mortgage was proved or acknowledged by whoever granted the mortgage. The statute, in the case of a corporate mortgage, doesn't require that the notary investigate and confirm that the individual who signs for a corporation was in fact an officer, in fact had authority. It merely requires identification. It serves the function only of giving confidence to the public that comes and looks at the recorder's records that a recorded instrument was signed by who it was purported to be signed by, not by an imposter. So the only rule that I have to satisfy gain enforceability of my client's mortgage is stated in several of the cases. That rule is the mortgage and the notary certificate read together must merely identify the individuals who acknowledged execution, identify them with the corporate mortgage or in an official or representative capacity or otherwise. It's a pretty loose test. We met that test by pointing to the manner in which the mortgage was executed. The mortgage was given both by a corporation and by individual mortgagors. The individuals signed separately to one side at the bottom of the page. The corporation signed separately, Garzolini Tire and Fuel, Inc., by Bruno Garzolini. He was the president, although his title wasn't noted, also with a notation below, attest Robert Garzolini. The form of that execution, Garzolini Tire and Fuel by Bruno Garzolini, clearly as a matter of law was sufficient to bind the corporation to a mortgage on this valuable piece of property. By the same token, I think the court must then conclude that it was also sufficiently identified the man with this corporation for purposes of the recording statute, creating an identification there. Secondly, in terms of identifying these individuals with the corporation, look at the second line, the attestation given by Robert Garzolini. In his signature line, he specifically adds the notation VP. He denotes himself as the vice president. That identifies him with the corporation. He attests the signature of Bruno Garzolini immediately above his. That, I believe, serves as a form of identification of Bruno with the corporation, as if the form of signature were not enough. It seems to me that my opponent's appeal requires this court to do one of two things for them to prevail. I think for the Garzolini Tire to prevail, they have to persuade you that the only way to identify an individual acknowledger with a corporation is to specifically say they're an officer, they're a president. The statute doesn't say that. The case law doesn't say that. You can look to other things. Other courts have looked to other things. Finally, the appellant relies heavily on a decision from 1944, the Indiana Court of Appeals Haverhill Manufacturing Corporation. In that case, like this, there was a corporate mortgage given by a corporation and an individual, signed by all three in a sort of combined fashion, acknowledged only by the individual, a man named Adolf Hauerlander. The court's concern in that case was, look, you got three different mortgagors, only the individual acknowledged. We can't tell if he meant to acknowledge only his individual signature or the corporate signatures as well. That is not good authority in this case. Look at the later decision by the Indiana Court of Appeals in Mishawaka Federal versus Bradamus. Similar situation, two mortgagors, only one signed, only one acknowledged. However you rule for the appellant, I don't believe you can rule on that theory. If the court has any questions, I'd like to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Roots?
Briefly, Your Honor. Following up on that Mishawaka Federal versus Bradamus case that Mr. Gallagher just cited, the actual language said 100 Center Company on its own behalf and as general partner of Sedgwick Homes. I would have no objection, and I would not be here today, had it been very clear throughout the three-step analysis of the Garzolini mortgage, if it had said Garzolini Tire and Fuel by its president, authorized representative, whatever, was signed by a representative. In this case, it was. And then the third in the acknowledgement, if it had simply said Garzolini Tire and Fuel by its president, authorized representative, whatever, Bruno Garzolini Jr. In that case, it's a very simple issue of Mishawaka Federal, it's a very simple issue of partnership law. Sedgwick House was a limited partnership. The controlling general partner was 100 Center Company, so it made it very simple when it said 100 Center Company as general partner of Sedgwick House.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.